Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Eddie Trunk here. Welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. You know the deal. It's free every Thursday. Podcast1.com and Apple Podcasts. Thank you for subscribing and listening each and every week to these great interviews that I bring for you, or to you, I should say. All of them originating on my daily Sirius XM show, Trunk Nation. Hear it on volume, channel 106, live daily, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, replaying every night, 10 to midnight Eastern, or on demand anytime you want on the Sirius XM app, including some cool video from some of my recent interviews you can see if you are a subscriber. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, truly hope you join me and listen every day. Here on the podcast, you are getting a tiny, tiny, tiny little taste of what I do on a daily basis on my daily Sirius XM radio show. Outside of the U.S. or Canada, glad to be able to give you a little taste of what I do on a daily basis here on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Like I said, new every Thursday at podcast1.com and on Apple Podcasts. So busy week coming up for me again next week. This coming weekend, I fly to Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. I will be there for a few days for an event called 80s in the Sand at the Breathless Spa and Resort. Sammy Hagar and Lita Ford among the rock artists performing. Looking forward to that. Never been there before. From there, I go to Los Angeles, get ready to host the annual Dio bowling event at Pins in Studio City. My bowling team consists of Brent Woods, Steven Adler, Dave Grohl, and Geezer Butler, along with our contest winner who donated some great money for charity for the Dio Cancer Fund. Cannot wait to see you. Frodo is always a wild event on November 7th in Studio City at Pins for Dio Bowling. And then from there, it's over to Houston, where I will host the second annual Foamhenge at the Carbach Brewing Company, featuring Accept and Ace Frehley and Pat Travers. It's going to be a great, great afternoon there in Houston. It was a great time doing that event last year. I'm thrilled to be back. Really cool spot, really cool location. Foamhenge, November 10th in Houston. If you're attending that, I'll see you there. That's the next run of rock and roll craziness coming up for me. Hope to see you out and about at these shows. Also, a quick note, my Sirius XM show on volume will be in best of mode, and that is for the week of November 4th. So I'm not going to do a live radio show around all that travel. I had a bunch of vacation time I needed to use from Sirius XM before I lost it. So I'm going to be in best of mode on the Sirius XM show the week of November 4th and Monday, November 11th, back with live shows on Tuesday, November 12th. You can enjoy all the best of stuff, including a lot of great best of programming you'll be getting in my 2 to 4, 10 to midnight Eastern slot if you are a listener on 106. And like I said, live shows resuming on November 12th. As far as the daily Sirius XM show. New podcast, of course, every Thursday here for you, regardless of wherever I'm at and whatever the hell I might be doing. So a double dip this week, a lot of interview content. So the open is going to be short. Two guitar greats for you. First up, Vivian Campbell. Vivian is, of course, the guitar player in Def Leppard, one of them at least, along with Phil Collin. He is also the sole guitar player in the band called Last in Line which has released two studio albums of original material and also includes Vinny Appice from the original Dio band. And they also do a bunch of Dio material from the first two albums. They've been opening some shows for UFO and also doing some headline shows around downtime that Viv has from Def Leppard. It's pretty remarkable because Vivian will go from playing a club with Last in Line and then shift right into playing like an arena or a stadium with Def Leppard, and love doing both. I give him a lot of credit for doing that. I've known Viv for a long time. We have a great conversation with him coming up as they were getting ready to play a show that has since happened in Tulsa that I hosted that was a lot of fun. But you'll hear us reference that show that has now happened already, but still an interview worth checking out. Second interview for you on this week's podcast, a guy I know a lot of people are going to be really excited to hear from, Frank Marino. Frank Marino is an extremely influential guitar player, but a guy that never had huge commercial success in America. He is Canadian. He just put out a new DVD Blu-ray. If you are in the know about Frank Marino, you are no doubt very excited about the fact that you're about to hear an interview with him, because he doesn't seem to do a lot of them. My first time talking to him, my first time meeting him, and I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. So Frank Marino, of Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush fame second. First up, Vivian Campbell of Def Leppard and Last in Line here on the Eddie Trunk podcast. Also, quick note, I did a broadcast last week from LA on my SiriusXM show with Kim Thayil of Soundgarden and also Mike Levine of Triumph. That is on demand on the SiriusXM app. There's video coming of that as well. That Rainbow broadcast was extremely last minute. I only did it on 3 days' notice. So I thank everybody who came out to it. And also, a big heads up, you know, I tell you guys all the time, please follow me on social media, because that's how I can tell you when last minute things and cool opportunities come up. I even give some stuff away via my social media, Twitter, where I am most active, at Eddie Trunk. And of course, Instagram, at Eddie Trunk. Fan page on Facebook, don't really do too much there. EddieTrunk.com, the official online home. So please follow on Twitter. Up to the second news info and updates. Do some stuff on Instagram as well. And of course, the website, music news, and my appearances and all that right there on EddieTrunk.com. All right, we'll come back. We'll start with Viv. We'll finish up with Frank Marino. Hope you guys enjoy this edition of the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, if you guys like my show, you're going to love the official Lakers podcast on Podcast One. Join Emmy Award-winning sports reporter Susie Schuster and co-host Aaron Lasul as they discuss the Lakers news of the day, break down the games from the week, and have exclusive interviews from players, coaches, and sports personalities. Don't miss the official Lakers podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcast.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome back to the quickest podcast ever, brought to you by Kohl's.
Today's topic, Mother's Day.
Just picking out some gifts at Kohl's. There's a KitchenAid mixer calling my name.
Your name? Doing some self-gifting, huh?
Nah, that's for my mom. Baking's her love language.
Love that.
The Fitbit, that's for me. Getting it for the self-care and the Kohl's cash.
That's a big deal.
So's the 20% off and free store pickup. I can get it all in less than an hour.
Talk about shopping goals.
20% offer valid April 28th through May 2nd. Some exclusions apply. See store or Kohl's.com for details.
Okay, parachutes ready.
Boy, the things I go through to get auto loan rates as low as 1.04% APR for 36 months on new vehicles with PenFed.
You are aware that you don't have to be a military member to save hundreds on your auto loan, aren't you? Anyone can join PenFed.
As someone terrified of heights, I probably should have looked into that.
Probably.
Drop me off at the shore.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/autos or call 1-800-247-5626. Advertised rates available through the PenFed Car Buying Service. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Eddie Trunk, and this is the Eddie Trunk Podcast. As promised, first up, Vivian Campbell, followed by Frank Marino. Let's get to Vivian now. Again, this conversation happened a few weeks ago. Some of the dates that we're talking about Last in Line playing have, of course, since happened, but I think you'll still enjoy the conversation with Vivian Campbell of Def Leppard and Last in Line, first up on this week's podcast. What's going on, Viv? How are you?
I am very well, Eddie, and yourself?
I'm good, man. A little, well, I'm not going to complain to you about travel and being a little burnt out from running around because I know you do your fair share of it, but I'm a little crispy at the moment, but I'm hanging in there.
Good job. Good job. Yeah. I'm bouncing all over the place as usual, you know.
I've been doing a lot of coast to coast. Well, you've been doing that because you actually live in LA, and also you were telling me where you're in Maine or something now?
New Hampshire. Yeah.
New Hampshire. So you're going back and forth a lot too, I would imagine.
Yeah. I'm in LA at the moment, and I've been there for about a week, and then I'm about to do some more shows with Last in Line. I actually have a Leopard show, Def Leppard Plan Festival did in Nashville on Saturday night, and then I fly from there on to Phoenix to start Last in Line run of shows, most of which involve our opening for UFO, which is a band you know something about.
Yep. Well, first of all, I'm hosting the festival in Tennessee this weekend, so I'll be seeing you.
Great. Oh, great. I'll see you then. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You guys are headlining one of the days. It's pretty cool. I don't know if you looked at the whole lineup, but it's everyone from – it's literally one of the days is Lynyrd Skynyrd and Slayer back-to-back on the same stage.
Fantastic. I had a quick look at who's on Saturday. I see ZZ Top are on one of the stages, and Ghost is a band I'd be interested to see also. Heard a lot of things about them.
Yeah, the headliners are one of the – you guys, I think, is Saturday, Guns N' Roses – one of the days, and then Skynyrd the other day, and just before Skynyrd is Slayer. I know in Europe, and you can speak more on this, but they mix the rock and classic rock and metal a lot more than they traditionally do here in the U.S., so I think this is going to be interesting to see how it works. But you see a lot of that in Europe, right?
Yeah, you do. Most of the European festivals are a little bit varied that way, and it seems to work, so I see no reason why it shouldn't work in the States.
So before we get to talking about Last in Line, because I'm excited about the dates you have coming up, one of which I'm going to be hosting with you in Tulsa, that's a headline show on the 19th of October, the IDL Ballroom, great spot, always a great time there in downtown Tulsa. My friend promotes the shows there, he brings me out to host, so I'm going to look forward to seeing you there as well. But before we get to all of that, you know, Joe Elliott was on this show with me like a week and a half ago talking about his side thing, the down and outs and the new record coming out. And I know you guys just wrapped up the latest Vegas residency. So on the Leopard side, how did that all go? How'd you feel about the latest run in Vegas?
That was so much fun. I mean, we put a stadium show into a theater in Vegas for the residency. I mean, it was the biggest production, the biggest stage we've ever had. So I don't think we'll make much money as a result. I think we put it all back into production. And it was great. It was wonderful. We tried to vary the show every night. You know, we had a core set list, but we had a couple of spots within that where we could, you know, pay homage to Paramania or to the Euphoria album or whatever. You know, and it was nice. I like it when we mix it up. It kind of kept us on our feet. You know, it's a bit more mental when you do a show like that, when you're not doing it by rote. You know, you got to kind of think about what's coming up next. And it was nice for me as a guitar player. I always like, as you know, to revisit, you know, the more rock stuff from the Paramania album and whatnot. You know, Billy's Got a Gun and Die Hard the Hunter and all that stuff. So it was great to do that.
I think Joe told me, because we spent a lot of time talking about this with Joe, like I said, just a couple weeks ago. But did you open with Die Hard the Hunter, I think he said?
We did, yeah. And it was epic. It really was. You know, it's such a great song to open with. It's such a dramatic song. You know, the way that the intro opens with acoustic guitar. Sav was playing an acoustic guitar on a stand. And and there's lots of guitar whittly bits for Phil and I in the middle of the song.
Well, I love the early stuff. I love all the Leopard stuff, but I love the first three, four records the best. And I mentioned to Joe as well that I know this is before your time in the band, of course, but it's crazy. Starting next year is the 40th of On Through the Night, and then quickly after it'll be the 40th of High and Dry, and then shortly after that it'll be the 40th of Pyromania. So it'd be a great opportunity to really dig into those records again. He said there is going to be some sort of special edition of the first record coming, so...
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe we'll play more of these shows where we get a chance to dig deep into that. I'm always a fan of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would think for you guys, you want to mix it up a little bit. I know for the, I know you've got Leopards in a unique situation or a great situation where they there's literally like 7-8 songs you have to play every show. But outside of that, whether it be the newer material or even something from like your first record Slang or early material, I would think it keeps you guys fresh as well, mixing it up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely it does. I mean, we would rather do that, to be honest, but it's, you know, we kind of are beholden to the hits, and you know, it's fair to say that a lot of Def Leppard fans that come to the show are kind of marginal fans. You know, they really only know those hits. And then, of course, there's the other 30 or 40% that are the diehards, and they really, 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 really want to hear those deep cuts, you know. So it's always a question of finding the balance, you know. I think, you know, for this show on Saturday in Tennessee, we are going to include a couple of songs that we haven't played for a while that are, you know, as a result of playing the Vegas residency. So that'll be nice. I think we're kind of in the frame of mind now where we can, we feel confident enough to mix it up.
Oh, well, I fly in tomorrow night. I'll be seeing you guys. I'll be sure to be in everybody's face and be annoying with requests from High and Dry. No problem.
Please do. Bring it.
I'll be pushing for Lady Strange and all that sort of stuff. And Joe will give me a crooked look.
Be pushing for. Yeah, you'll be pushing a while for that one.
What about the song On Through the Night or Mirror, Mirror? See, don't get me started. I get too geeky.
Mirror, we played in Vegas. I'd say we could turn that one out on Saturday night if you lobby hard enough, you know?
Oh, yeah? Another hit and run? Have you done that?
We haven't played that in a few years, but that's a simple enough song, I'm sure, with a bit of practice, you know?
So good. Yeah. So that's great stuff. All right. Well, here's what's interesting now, and I was talking about this with the audience before. So everybody in Leopard pretty much has another thing they do on the side. Joe was on with me recently to promote Down and Outs, and his new record with that is coming out in 2 days. So you, of course, have had the second album with Last in Line that's been out for a little while, Last in Line 2. But I know the challenge is, because Leopard has been so active lately around the world, the challenge is finding the windows where you can go out with Andrew, with Phil, with Vinny, and tour and support and tell people about this band. And I'm looking over the dates. I mentioned the one in Tulsa, you mentioned some with UFO, but I'm looking over the dates and it looks like to me this is pretty much the longest, most consistent run in the U.S. you've probably had in a little while, right?
It's certainly in a while. You know, maybe 3 years ago or something we did a longer run in the U.S. but yeah, so we're starting next Tuesday the 15th in Phoenix with UFO. And then we go to San Antonio again with UFO, and then we got a show of our own in Houston, and then we got the show that you're going to be at, Tulsa, this Saturday night.
That's Saturday, October 19th, yeah.
Yeah, and so we have a run of shows that, and then at the end of that, we tagged on a show, another show with Def Leppard. Def Leppard is doing a one-off show at an amphitheater that's just opening outside of Sacramento on November 2nd, and Last in Line are going to open that show, so I'm doing double duty that night.
Really?
Yes. Indeed.
Have you ever done that?
Yeah, well, I did it at the Download Festival in the UK in June. This past June, we opened, Last in Line opened the main stage, and Def Leppard closed it that night. And in between, I took a nap. So this will be interesting to do. So it's this Sacramento show on November 2nd. I can't remember the name of the amphitheater offhand, but there's three bands on the bill. Obviously, it's Def Leppard headlining the show. Last in Line are opening the show, and Don Felder.
Oh, wow.
Strange bill, but there you go. So that'll be fun. And then after that, we've got another four shows on the East Coast with Last in Line. And then a couple of weeks later, we go to Europe, and we've got a couple of week run over there in the UK and mainland Europe. So it's been busy enough. You know, as you said, I do try and fit in as many shows. Literally, I mean, especially this last year or two, when I'm not working with Def Leppard, I'm working with Last in Line and vice versa. So it's been very, very busy for me. But I'm happy to do it. I really enjoy my work with both bands. And in the case of Last in Line, I mean, you really do need to go out and do the shows. You can't just, you know, do what we're doing now, have an interview or whatever and make a video and put a record out. You really got to manifest things and, you know, you got to go out and play live, and that's what it's all about. And it's a lot of fun to do, you know, so, and it keeps me sharp. I mean, I really think I'm playing the best I've ever played in my entire career as a result of this, you know, and enjoying my work with both Def Leppard and Last in Line. And I think that's true of the other guys in Leopard 2, you know, with Phil and with Joe, you know, they go off and do things with Down and Outs and Delta Deep, and they come back, and we all kind of come back to Def Leppard a little bit more fresh, you know, a little bit more sharp.
Yeah, well, it gives everybody a chance to stretch out into some different territory and do some different things. For you, I know, by the way, that other date you wanted me to mention, that or you were trying to find the name of the venue, Toyota Amphitheater, Wheatland, California. I see it on your website, November 2nd. That's the show you're doing double duty.
That would be it, yeah.
And lastinlineofficial.com to see all the dates, because that's where I just got that information from if you want to find out. But Viv, for you, I know that when you started Last in Line, that part of it was sort of re-embracing all the Dio stuff that you were such a big part of early on, but it was also about being able to exercise another side of your guitar playing, right?
Yeah, it was about, you know, just that aggressive style of guitar playing that I grew out of. You know, it came, my desire to play with Vinny and Jimmy Bain again in 2011 was right off the back of my doing a tour with Thin Lizzy as a stunt guitar player. And, you know, as you know, Lizzy were a very, very influential band for me. And just, you know, being on stage with Brian Downey and Scott Gorham and playing Emerald and Black Rose and The Rocker and all this stuff, and Don't Believe a Word, you know, it brought me back and kind of reignited that passion again. So it was great. You know, it was like finding a lost love. I think anything that is your passion that becomes your career, you really, you know, you'll notice that it'll ebb and flow over the years. You know, it's very hard to keep that fire burning with the same intensity. And I'm very happy to say that I discovered that again around 2010, 2011. And I've been stoking the fire ever since, you know, which is why I think I'm playing better than ever. You know, I'm very comfortable with how I'm playing. I find it effortless now. I find it really easy and flowing out of me. I'm writing a lot. We've actually started writing again for the next Last in Line record, which we'll probably start recording in January. And, you know, when I was actually in Vegas in August and September with Def Leppard for the residency there, we had 4 days of writing with Last in Line in between Leppard shows. So, you know, it was good to take advantage of that time. And the new record, I would say, is probably 80% written already, and it sounds great. I mean, it's just a progression from the second album, and, you know, very ambitious, very musical. We're really kind of stretching our muscles on it. So I'm excited. I love what I do. I'm a lucky guy. You know.
Yeah, no. And you know what's interesting too is for people that like with Last in Line, it originally started out to basically just play stuff from the first three Dio records, and then you made that decision for it to be kind of become its own band. Now you've got two studio records with a third one being written. Where is the balance now when you play live for people coming to these shows, whether they be headline dates or they be dates with UFO or any of the stuff you have coming up? What are you doing balance wise as far as material? Is it 50-50 from original to the Dio stuff you and Vinny did?
Yeah,
or how's the breakdown?
In our own shows, when we can play about, you know, 90 or 100 minutes or whatever, it's about a 50-50 balance. It kind of varies on the opening slots. You know, when we open for UFO, I believe they're giving us a solid 60-minute opening slot, which is great. So we can fit 10 songs into that. So it'll probably be, you know, five of each. Or maybe six and four. I don't know yet what the set's going to be for the opening slot. But, yeah, we're on average about 50-50. When we did the Download Festival, as I mentioned earlier, this past June, when I did Double Duty, both Last in Line and Def Leppard, we only had a 30-minute slot because we were the first band on the main stage. And we decided to make a statement for that because it was such a high-profile show. We fit in six songs and we played five of our own. The only Dio song we played there was Rainbow in the Dark, which we closed with. So it was a bit of a statement by us, and we felt that it was a good opportunity to make that statement because it is principally a new band. You know, even though we've taken our name from the second Dio album, and I think we might have talked about this before. You know, had I known back then in mid-2011 when we were just jamming for the first time and I said, let's go out and do some club shows. And I was the idiot who said, let's call it Last in Line. That seems appropriate. Ronnie's passed away. Jimmy and Vinny and I were the Last in Line. And it's the name of a song and name of an album we wrote and recorded with Ronnie. So it made perfect sense. But back then, I had no idea that it was going to get to the stage where we'd have a couple of albums out, you know, and be working on our third. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword to name a band after a classic album of a previous band, you know. So it's always going to be a bit of a battle for us to find that right balance. But as long as the band is together and as long as we're called Last in Line, we will always be playing songs from those early Dio records. You know, we just got to find the balance.
And it took you a long time to come around to embracing that music. I mean, I know when we've talked about this, when you started with Ronnie, you were very, very young and you know, fairly inexperienced in the big picture of the music business and all that. But I remember talking to you long before you ever did Last in Line, and you seemed to have really sort of a conflicted feeling about the early stuff you did with Dio. And I remember always saying to you, man, Viv, so many people love that, and what you did on those records is so iconic. And you seem to have really come full circle on it now, where not only are you doing it with Last in Line, but like you said, embracing it and acknowledging that side of you as a player. I mean, how did that happen? Like, what was there an event? Was it Ronnie's passing or something prior to that? Was there something that sort of tripped for you to say, hey, I should be proud of this, and let me go back and rediscover it a little bit?
Yeah, you're right. It did take a long time, and it has come full circle. And a lot of different things happened, and a lot of different things were pivotal in getting to where it is. You know, the way I was fired from the band, and after having invested so much of my energy and my passion into those first three Dio albums, you know, it hurt so much for so many years, and I wanted nothing to do with it, and I didn't look at it as my legacy. And in fact, you know, the first album, the Holy Diver album in particular, I was young and I was very naive, and I signed away all my rights to Ronnie and Wendy to that, and to this day I still don't get paid for it, you know, which is, I kind of had to get over all of that, but I looked at the catalog very, very differently. Yes, it was Ronnie's legacy, but it was also Jimmy Bean's and Vinnie Appice's, and very much mine as well, and we all collectively created those early albums, and they were great records, and they're records to be proud of, and I am very proud of them now. But it took a long time to get to that stage. And Ronnie's passing, yeah, I'll be very honest about this. Ronnie's passing did have something to do with that. You know, you can't bear any ill will to people in the afterlife. You know, Ronnie is gone, and I have been willing to forgive, not forget, but to forgive that and to move on with my life. You know, it's not good to go through life hanging on to negative feelings, you know. So I look at the music very, very differently now. I still don't get paid for it, but it still gives me great joy, you know, because I created something beautiful and something that other people derive great happiness from, and it gives me great happiness to perform it still, you know. So it's good, you know. The music itself is its own reward, you know. So I'm very, very blessed to be able to look at it that way.
When you dig back into this stuff and you look at material to play from those first three records with Last in Line, are there any personal highlights for you? Are there songs that you kind of totally forgot about? Did you listen all three records top to bottom, or at least look at the track listing and say, I mean, obviously there's the obvious one. There's the obvious ones, Rainbow in the Dark, Last in Line, you know, We Rock, Stand Up and Shout, whatever. But did you look at it and be like, oh, wow, it'd be kind of cool to do Egypt or Sacred Heart or something, where there's some things that jumped out at you that you even sort of rediscovered, even though you had a big hand in them?
Yeah, all of that. I mean, we are actually playing Egypt. It's pretty much a highlight of the show for me as a guitarist, because I get to go off and do a whole extended solo at the end. We go very free form on it. You know, songs like Evil Eyes was always a fun song that we didn't play too much back in the day with Dio. Invisible was a song that we've played a bunch with Last in Line, and we only ever played it once with Dio. In fact, it was the very, very first show that the original Dio band ever did at the Concert Barn in Antioch, California. So I remember the show very, very well. And that was the only time that Dio, the band, ever played Invisible. So you know, there's a lot of those songs other than, as you mentioned, the you know, the title tracks, Last in Line, Holy Diver, you know, Don't Talk to Strangers, those sort of big songs. To be honest, we in Last in Line, we haven't played much, and certainly not recently, we haven't played much, if anything, from the Sacred Heart album. That's a different, a difficult record for us to look at. You know, it was a very painful record to make for all of us, Ronnie included. Ronnie's mood was very dark, and that's kind of when the wheels really started to come off, and the band was in trouble, and I think everyone was kind of aware of that. But it's not a bad record, you know. It's maybe just our own personal reflections on it that make it difficult for us to play it. Although Vinny has recently, in recent weeks, lobbied for us playing King of Rock and Roll again, which is a song that we did play. We played that in the title track, Sacred Heart, when we were first doing Last in Line shows. And so we might get back to playing King of Rock and Roll in the show, but it remains to be seen. Right now, the bulk of the Dio legacy material that we're playing comes from the first two albums.
Well, I think that would be what most people would want to hear anyway. But yeah, something like the title track to Sacred Heart or King of Rock and Roll would be great to hear. And now, of course, you're going to start to, especially once you get a third record out, you're going to have a nice problem where you're going to have those three records and then three records of your own. So you're really going to have to work that balance and figure out where the band's going to go.
Exactly, but like I said, as long as the band is called Last in Line, we were definitely going to play some Dio material, and I think we always will. We've got it, as you said, it's a nice problem to have. We have a problem in Def Leppard where there's so much catalog, and we're beholden to the hits. It's a similar kind of thing, but it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And talk for a second, if you will, Viv, because of course Jimmy Bain was in Last in Line and was a big part of that first record and on that first record, and we all know the story. I was there. Tragically, he passed away on that Def Leppard cruise. Phil Soussan comes in and has now been in the band and has now made a record with you guys and has been touring with you for a while. How has that all worked out?
Perfect, actually. Jimmy was Scottish, Phil is English, so it keeps the two Americans and two European balance, which is what the original Dio band had, and which is what we've always had in Last in Line with Jimmy from the start. We've carried that through with Phil. Obviously, he's cut from the same cloth, having been with Ozzy back in the 80s. He's an incredible musician. I'd say musically, he's not the same kind of bass player that Jimmy was. Jimmy was such an epic, toneful player and such a fundamental player. Jimmy's timing was impeccable. He was just really foundational in his playing and his sound. Phil is a much more ambitious, much more adventurous bass player, kind of like John Entwistle to The Who and Geezer Butler in Sabbath. He finds a pocket to fill, and a place to make a statement. He's an ambitious musician. He's a great songwriter. And he's really fit into the band very, very well. He's got a great sense of humor, which is exceptionally important for this band and indeed for any band. You spend a lot of time, as we call it, in submarine duty, in a van or whatever, or in a dressing room. So we've got to get along, and I'm happy to say that we all do. And we have a lot of laughs and a lot of good times together. And he's very easy to work with. And he's a great writer, and his input has been immense with the second album, as it has been on this upcoming record.
It's funny, I saw something making the rounds on social media where I guess you did a Last in Line interview and somebody, you had to defend the fact that Last in Line was not a money grab. And I just laughed out loud at that, because I'm like, how stupid could somebody be to think like I've seen you, like, I've told the story, 1 year, I saw you at Rocklahoma 1 year playing on the side stage in the middle of the day with your dressing room, a tiny little trailer with no bathroom over there. And then the next year you played Rocklahoma with Leppard headlining the main stage with the whole artist compound. I'm like, what are people talking about? If there's anything that ever wasn't a money grab, it's your desire to go literally from stadiums to clubs to play this music that you like. I mean, I don't know where people come up with this stuff. It's crazy.
Well, people don't know how the industry works, people think that we're millionaires because Jimmy and Vinny and I wrote the Holy Diver album with Ronnie. It's like we don't get a penny for it still to this day. But, that's we have to kind of recalibrate our thinking about that. Like I said earlier, it's the reward is the music itself. It'd be great to get paid for it. But, guess what? I'm very fortunate. I get paid with Def Leppard. and I make a very comfortable living doing that. My work with Last in Line is a passion project. I fly Southwest Airlines. I carry my own guitar. I'm excited when I get to stay in a Holiday Inn Express because that's as good as it gets. You know, I'm also excited when the Sprinter van drive is less than 500 miles. You know, I'm excited when I get to eat something other than another cheese sandwich. It's hard work. It's a graft, but it's I would do it for free. And I literally do it for free because I can and because I want to, you know, and it's all I ever wanted to do was play angry rock guitar, and I get to do it. And fortunately, I'm very well compensated for my work with Leopard, and that affords me the opportunity to be able to work with Last in Line. So, you know, but people, I don't know how a plumber makes a living. I don't know how an electrician or a real estate agent or a banker or a secretary or anyone makes their work, or a car mechanic, you know, so I don't expect people to understand how the music business works, you know.
Right, right. I would imagine it helps keep you grounded a little bit too. I mean, from one minute playing a stadium with Leopard to, a few days later playing a small club or something somewhere for 100, 200 people, I'm sure that keeps things in check. That's a good sort of balance at times to keep you kind of grounded in some way, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're actually, Andrew, you know, sometimes when we're on stage with Last in Line, especially right after it happened, you know, he tries to embarrass me by introducing me as the guitar player in Def Leppard and being in the Hall of Fame and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, yeah, it does. The pendulum swings from one extreme to the other, you know. But I have always tried to keep both feet on the ground, you know. And this certainly helps me. Yeah.
And one more thing on Dio before I let you go. I never really heard your thoughts on this, and obviously you worked with Ronnie for a number of years and made three very, very classic records, certainly two extremely classic in those first two, and certainly knew the guy very well at one point when you played with him. What is your take on the it's not just Ronnie. I mean, other people are rolling out holograms too, but what is your take on the Dio hologram? Do you have any thoughts or comments on it?
Well, I haven't seen it, to be honest. And it's not something I need to see because obviously I was there. I performed on stage with Ronnie hundreds and hundreds of times. But I realize that there's a whole generation of people who never got the chance to see Ronnie. So for them, it's a very valid thing. You know, it's helping to keep the legacy of Dio music alive. And that's a good thing. It's good for all of us. I mean, good for me. It's good for Vinny. It's good for Jimmy's memory. So I have no bones with it. You know, if people want to go see it, it's a very different thing to what we do with Last in Line. But I mean, holograms in general, I've never witnessed it in the flesh. I don't know how realistic it looks, how scary it would look. it remains to be seen, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's an emerging thing. I was in a casino a couple months ago, and there was the act playing in the casino was a double bill of Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison.
And oh my
I was
God.
Like, I looked three times at the poster, and then it said real small underneath, you know, produced by whatever holograms. And I was like, wow, this is really becoming a thing.
Well, we are living in a world that's becoming more and more disassociated and more virtual, you know? But one thing that will never, ever be able to be replicated is the interaction between real musicians playing in real time, you know, in a room, any sort of an environment, an arena or a club or a theater or whatever. It's, you know, it vibrates through your entire core being, you know, and it's a very existential sort of a feeling, you know, and it's why I love doing what I love doing and why playing live is the greatest aspect of my career. You know, songwriting is great, recording is great and all that, but when you play live on stage with great musicians and to an audience, and it's an interactive, social sort of a thing, it's a communal experience, and, you know, that's something that's becoming more and more rare, I think, because there's a whole generation of new bands coming up who maybe don't play live a lot. You know, there's a lot of tracks.
Oh, it's my biggest peeve in the world, my friend, is the is bands not playing live. It's I am on a mission, and it's don't even get me started. It's got to stop. But it's the most un-rock and roll thing in the world to me as a fan. But you're 100% right.
I'm encouraged that, you know, both with Def Leppard and with Last in Line, like I look out and I see people who are in their teens and their 20s, their early 30s, you know, and it's they're keeping live music supported and keeping it alive. And they're, even if they can't maybe verbalize what it is about a live show that really turns them on, I mean, there is something about it. It's a unique in-the-moment experience. I mean, my pet peeve about it is I wish people would put their friggin' cell phones down and just enjoy the experience. You know, they're experiencing it less because of that, but it's something very special, and it's very, very magical. And no matter how tricky technology gets, it'll never replicate that. You know, it's real music needs to be live. That's the greatest environment to experience it. And it doesn't matter what genre of music, it doesn't matter if it's rock music or classical music. I don't know if you've ever witnessed an orchestra play in the right kind of room. I mean, it can bring you to tears. I mean, it's just so emotional and so impactful and so physical, you know, the way that music just flows through your body when you're in the room with real musicians playing live, and that those interactions. So, it's what it's all about to me. And that's why I fly Southwest and stay at Holiday Inn Express, you know, and eat another cheese sandwich. So.
But that's what it's about for me as a fan. It's got, like, I want to see my bands live, warts and all. I can't do, you know, if I find out a band's all, you know, running tracks and lip sync vocals and this is on tracks, I have zero interest. I'd rather listen to the record, to the whole energy, the whole excitement of seeing a band and actually being able to evaluate if they had a good night or a bad night is based on a band truly playing live, you know, plug in, let me hear you go. Let's hear you sing. Let's hear you play. And I just think that that's something that cannot get lost in rock music. We need that, and we need the, and I'm seeing more and more, Vivian, you know, Joe, I know, has been outspoken about it, but a lot of bands, you know, Sebastian Bach is out there on tour right now, and he actually put out a press release saying, I want everybody to know I'm actually playing 100% live. It's ridiculous that live bands actually have to own that, but that's what, it's gotten so bad that that's what they need to do, to let people know, hey, we're the genuine article here. We're actually putting the work in and actually singing and playing live.
Yeah, but I think people can tell, you know, I mean, for the greater part, you know, it's, you can't really fool people. I mean, all the senses aren't being fulfilled if it's not live, you know, and I think people kind of pick up on that. So, but yeah, it's, catch it while you can, you know, it's not gonna last forever.
That's sad if that's the case, but I have to believe there will always be guys that actually plug in and go for it and actually do it 100% real. And obviously you're doing that with both of the bands, Last in Line and Leppard, and that's a great thing to see. Again, we'll redirect everybody to Last in Line Official to find a date near you, because it is rare that Vivian has a chance to go out and really work with this great band. And I've seen Last in Line a bunch of times. It's a great, great show. It's a great band. Andrew sings his ass off. We didn't even touch on him. Vinny is still a beast, even, you know, after all these years, just one of the most incredible drummers to watch, hit so hard, love them to death. So it's really a lot of fun, and I'm thrilled that you guys are firing this up again. Last thing before I let you go, because I have to ask you this, and this is more important than anything we've talked about. And, you know, I reminded people earlier, you are a fighter and a survivor here with cancer. How is your health?
Well, it's actually my back is the issue at the moment. I did spine surgery last Wednesday. So I'm sitting here with an ice pack and a back brace on.
Oh, wow.
So I'm a little concerned about that. I'm, you know, it's going to be difficult for me to do these next couple of weeks worth of shows. I'm going to be moving very slowly, but I know that I can get on stage and I can play guitar and I can sing. And so that's all I need to do. It'll be the travel in between that's going to be extremely uncomfortable. But as far as the cancer, you know, I'm just doing these infusions. I go back to City of Hope tomorrow and get another infusion, and that'll keep me right for another 3 to 4 weeks. And, you know, it's just maintenance. So it's all good as far as I'm concerned.
Is it the type of thing, Viv, that will ever fully go into remission, or the type of thing you're going to have to manage the rest of your life?
Right now it's just holding, you know, and it has been for 4 years. So I'm very fortunate that, you know, I caught my cancer early enough to where this is okay to keep it in this holding pattern. So until something else comes along, the technology is moving at a furious pace. I mean, there's so many new cancer treatments and alternative treatments coming to light year after year. The treatment that I'm on, in fact, I was part of a clinical trial of that. That's relatively new. So, I'm very fortunate that way that I caught it early and I happen to be a good candidate for this particular treatment, and it's a good placeholder. So it doesn't really have any impact on my life, you know, other than scheduling and a little bit tired a few days around the infusions. But like I say, right now it's kind of slid to second place on the complaints list, you know, because of the back surgery. So that's my more pressing concern. It's always something, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we're all getting older, man. And I feel it every day when I get out of bed, too. And with all the travel, it's like my foot hits the floor and it's like, oh, my God, what happened? I don't know. I'm just waking up. I don't know what happened.
Sure, the music keeps us young, you know.
I agree with that fully. I completely do. I'm a believer that rock and roll keeps us young, and I will definitely sign for that. Well, listen, man, get some rest, and I'll see you in Tennessee this weekend. Bring a jacket. I'm told it's gonna the temps are gonna drop a lot at night. I'm told. So,
yes, indeed.
I'll see you in. I'll see you at exit 111. With well, that, I'll see bring both of you. Bring yeah. Well, your jacket won't fit me, unfortunately. But what's that?
Oh, Phil, bring one for Phil.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Phil's not going to go the shirtless route, I don't think, this weekend. But this, I'm going to see you in both of your worlds, man, because I'm going to host Exit 111 with you this weekend and see you headline a day at an enormous rock festival with Leopard. And then a week later, I'm going to see you and intro you at a club in Tulsa for Last in Line. So I am going to live the both worlds of Vivian Campbell in the next week. I can't wait.
Excellent, Eddie. I appreciate that. You're living the dream with me, huh?
Exactly. Okay. Take care of yourself, man. Good talking to you, and I'll see you. I'll see you this weekend.
Cheers, Eddie. Thanks. Bye bye.
Bye bye. There he goes, everybody. Vivian Campbell. Great to talk with him, and a lot of good stuff there. My thanks to Vivian Campbell. And those shows with Last in Line, really, really good. Had a chance to see them a couple of times, both opening for UFO and that headline show that I hosted there in Tulsa. All right, we'll come back. Second interview on this week's podcast, the legendary, iconically influential guitar player Frank Marino. He's next.
As always, a big thank you for listening to the show. We'd like to ask a small but very important favor of you. It'll only take a few minutes, and if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time. We need you to complete a short survey, because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and you as a listener. Just go to podcastone.com/survey, and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. The first 250 people who complete the survey will get a $10 gift card to Amazon.com, and two grand prize winners will be selected at random to get a $100 Amazon gift card. How about that? Free money. It's a win-win. Our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us cater to the needs of you as a loyal listener. Go to podcastone.com/survey, answer some questions, and potentially make some money along the way. From all of us here at Podcast One, thank you for being a dedicated listener.
Welcome back to the quickest podcast ever, brought to you by Kohl's.
Today's topic, Mother's Day.
Just picking out some gifts at Kohl's. There's a KitchenAid mixer calling my name.
Your name? Doing some self-gifting, huh?
Nah, that's for my mom. Baking's her love language.
Love that.
The Fitbit, that's for me. Getting it for the self-care and the Kohl's cash.
That's a big deal.
So's the 20% off and free store pickup. I can get it all in less than an hour.
Talk about shopping goals.
20% offer valid April 28th through May 2nd. Some exclusions apply. See store or Kohl's.com for details.
Okay, parachutes ready.
Boy, the things I go through to get auto loan rates as low as 1.04% APR for 36 months on new vehicles with PenFed.
You are aware that you don't have to be a military member to save hundreds on your auto loan, aren't you? Anyone can join PenFed.
As someone terrified of heights, I probably should have looked into that.
Probably.
Drop me off at the shore.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/autos or call 1-800-247-5626. Advertised rates available through the PenFed Car Buying Service. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Eddie Trunk back with you on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. As promised, Frank Marino, a Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush fan, fame, I should say, a guy that so many people are fans of that went on to have huge success, maybe the biggest being Zach Wilde, who absolutely worships Frank. Don't hear from him all that often. This is the very first time I ever talked to the guy or met the guy. We talk about his new Blu-ray. The interview, as you're about to hear, happened over the phone, but it was great talking to him. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here is Frank Marino on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. Frank, it's nice to meet you over the phone. How are you?
It's great to meet you too, Eddie. I'm pretty good. Everything's okay.
I've heard nothing but amazing things about some of your shows in, say, the last, they've been sporadic. I know there's not been a lot of them, but friends of mine have seen you play in recent years, just come back raving and raving. And it's long overdue that we get a chance to chat. And obviously this new collection that's just come out is pretty exciting. The fans seem to be really pumped, and it's an amazing set. Tell me a little bit about how this came together.
Well, it was a long time in the making. I never really wanted to do a lot of video stuff because I always just, you know, I preferred the audio portion of music. But for years and years, you know, many people in the industry have been saying to me, you know, Frank, you got to do video. Everybody does video. And I avoided it for a long, long time until a couple of people who, they happened to be the video producers for Bruce Springsteen. They'd done a lot of, you know, like 12 or 13 with him, and they just kept telling me, you got to do one. I just wouldn't do one. And finally the guy said, if you're not going to do it, we're going to do it. So I was doing this gig in Cleveland at the Agora, and they showed up with their trucks and everything and said, we're doing that video you should have been doing 10 years ago. So they did. They recorded it, and in the end, it turned out to be pretty cool. I decided that if I was going to do one, I wanted to do as much as possible in one day. So I said, look, rather than just play a gig, let's just play all day. And, you know, let's play the night before. We'll have a sound check. And then the next day we'll play for, you know, 12 hours and take a couple of breaks. And so we did. We recorded a whole bunch of stuff, and everything was good. And then there was a little problem with the audio, which took me a few years to fix. But here it is. It's done. It's great. And I'm happy it's done.
Well, yeah, because the collection as it is I think clocks in at somewhere around 6 hours. But so that is wild. So you're telling me that this, I'm assuming, was shot a few years ago, but you went and you played basically for an audience that long? The set was that long?
Yeah, normally I do 3 to 4 hour shows. Okay, so that's not crazy for me, but the night before, you know, we had the Friday night where we just, you know, let the people in anyway. And we basically, you know, sound checked and got everything ready and played from, 7 o'clock till midnight. And then the next day we came back at noon and we started around 1 and we finished around 1 in the morning. But we took a couple of breaks in the day. And out of all of that, I basically gleaned six solid hours of music. I didn't put any of the talking and stuff into the DVD production. I just figured, you know, people want to see the music, so put it together as a concert. And it's actually three sets, if you want to put it this way, and put them in the set like that. I just felt that, you know, maybe one day we could do the rest of it. You never know. But but yeah, that's what it ended up being, 6 hours out of the 12 or more that we actually did.
How many people that were in the room in terms of audience, what percentage would you say actually watched the entire thing?
100%.
Really?
Just, yeah, they don't leave. It's always been like that with us. We have a really sort of a dedicated kind of, I hate to use the word fan base because I'm more like supporters, you know. I think fans,
right,
is kind of like a bit, you know, different than I'd like to say. So they're supporters. They've supported the act. Some people have said, you know, that the fans of the group are almost like deadheads, all right, in the sense that they, you know, follow us from gig to gig. And they're,
yeah, I was going to say, it sounds kind of like a jam band mentality that's kind of common in the jam band community.
Yeah, Eddie, totally. I mean, look, that's what I did in the late 60s. Like, when I started, you know, that's what the band is. I mean, let's face it, I'm not a singing star, and it's not like we had pop tunes or hits and stuff like that. It really is an original jam band.
Yeah.
And we still do that to this day. Like what you see on this Blu-ray or this DVD is pretty much what we've always done. And it's very, very natural. It's just the way I was started in music, you know, and I've always maintained that, you know. It's just something I do because I like it and I love it, actually. And I think, you know, we've got those kind of supporters that kind of like that too. They're not all players, by the way. You know, it's not just guitarists and players that follow what we do. It's people that like that kind of organic, you know, make it up as you go music type of thing. Although there are songs, of course, from the albums, but it's a lot of it's jamming.
Yeah, no, that is wild. I didn't realize it was to that degree and that it was a full weekend experience to go and see Frank Marino. And, you know, that does make sense now, too, because obviously you're and I talk about this all the time. The 70s were the era for the live record. They were and the live record could break a band in the 70s. They were landmark releases. Unfortunately, not much of note in terms of real success for live records since the 70s, but there's so many great live ones, including Frank Marino, Mahogany Rush Live. And I notice in looking at the liner notes to that record, even back then, you wrote that you would apologize because due to the confines of even a double record or whatever, you weren't able to present your full show even then.
Right, we weren't. And the label that I was on at the time, which was Columbia, was very adamantly against me even doing a live record. And so, you know, they were like, you know, no, you've got to do, you know, another studio record. And I mean, you know, they were fighting me from day one. That's why I finally left in the 80s. It was just like I couldn't take it. Every album was an argument. But when we finally did insist on having the live record done, they put it out. Half of that record was not released. There's still more of that record somewhere. You know, that they didn't release, and that sort of upset me at the time, because they just, you know, they wouldn't get behind it. The funny thing about it, though, is that, you know, here we are in, 2019, and if you look at the Columbia catalog, I mean, they're still selling that record, so, of all the Mahogany Rush records, so it turned out that they were quite wrong about how people might accept a live album, you know. Look, our band has always been supported by the public. You know, we really never got a whole lot of radio. We did a couple of TV shows and we were on the radio for a couple of tunes, but certainly not the hundreds of tunes we did do. But from a live perspective, that's where the bulk of our support always came from, you know, from all the festivals and the gigs that we did. So I'm really not surprised that people would want to, you know, fans of the band would want to hear music from our live show because that's really where we do what we do. I should say this about jamming, Eddie. You know, a lot of people mistake the idea of jamming in jam bands as, you know, some guy taking a solo and then another guy taking a solo. You know, really jamming is when you're inventing the music as you go. And you only do that if you're listening to the other guys in the band and you're not just waiting for your turn to take a solo. Like genuine jamming, if you think about it from a jazz perspective, you know, guys listen to the other guys in the band, they invent as they go, and it's quite likely that when you're jamming properly, you're going to invent a unique experience each time that you do it. It won't be a repetition of what you did on any other given night. So when I say jam band, that's kind of what I mean. I don't just mean wanking.
right.
Yeah,
of course. And, you know, you have no doubt a dedicated, as you mentioned, very, very loyal, passionate fan base out there that people hear about you even now. And whether it be a guy like Zakk Wylde or Steve Vai or any of these guys, Kirk Hammett, that talk about how important you were to shaping their playing, that all obviously maybe puts newer, younger eyes on Frank Marino and what he's done. And, you know, you must feel that going on right now. I'm sure that's something that you know after even all these decades. Do you feel like there's new people because of some of these major name players that you influenced
yeah.
in terms of commercial appeal, pointing to you and saying, hey, you got to check out Frank Marino?
Absolutely, Zach, especially, you know, Marty Friedman, Frank Hannon, you know, a lot of Uli Roth, a lot of these guys have been, you know, very instrumental in helping other people say, hey, you know, I should check out this guy because, you know, I mean, even Frederick Hawkinson from Opeth and some of the newer bands, you know, they're all doing sort of the same thing. Arch Enemy, you know, all genres of kind of
right.
guitar players in bands have sort of pointed to what I did and what I'm doing from the 70s on. I think basically that comes from the fact that, you know, I've been in this business now 50 years, like this year. And when I started, it was kind of unusual at the time because I was 16. You know, it was unusual to have a 16-year-old, you know, producing and making albums and being on, you know, going on tour playing a wild electric guitar. But years later, it started to become the norm. And by that time, that's when a lot of these guys were, became influenced. It wasn't really so much what Frank was playing. It was, and I hate to say third person stuff, but it was the fact that he was, you know. So I think a lot of these guys realized that they could all do the same kind of thing. They're a little younger than me by about 10 years. And so that's how it happened, and that's why they say it today. You know, similar to maybe the way I felt about, let's say, Johnny Winter or Jimi Hendrix or guys like that. That's sort of what they've done. But they've helped immensely to broaden the scope of the audience. And I really don't think their audiences are disappointed in any way when they do, you know, turn on what we do and see that it really is an early influence of what they do.
Now, here in America, I mean, I know you were on huge shows back in the day, Cal Jam and all that sort of stuff, and you were certainly out there. But as you alluded to before, the big commercial success, the hit song, that big crossover moment pretty much eluded you most of your career. Did you find that frustrating? Was that something you were sort of chasing, or were you so much sort of in this free spirit, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it mode, that you knew that was probably going to come with the territory, being that creative and expressing yourself the way you do?
I think the last time that I was disappointed about that lack of support at the radio level, let's say, was probably on my first album, just because they, you know, the record company that had signed me at the time had made this big allusion to, you know, the fact that, you know, this is going to be something and it's going to be on the radio. And at the time, we didn't really want to even do that. We were considered a counterculture band. And, you know, I considered us a counterculture band that were just doing it to have fun. And these guys sort of talked us into recording. They were like, you know, the enemy. Oh, no, we're going to, you know, get hooked up with the establishment. This is what people were thinking in 69, 70, 71. And so, you know, we did this thing. And then, of course, it didn't really do anything at radio. And I think I was a bit disappointed because they had kind of convinced me that it might do something. But by the second album, that I had totally, you know, not cared about it because I really didn't before either. And so by the second album, I just started doing what I wanted to be doing. And consequently, a lot of those songs are too long for the radio, too many solos for the radio, not enough harmony vocals, you know. So naturally, I never expected it. And when we did get some radio play, for instance, late at the end of the 70s, you know, I think it was in 1980 or something, we finally got what was considered a number one radio hit with a song called Strange Dreams. It was not intended to even be that. It was just one of the songs from the album that happened to catch on at, I think it was KLOS, and it became number one for, you know, on 160 stations for many weeks, as I recall. But the funny thing about that tune is that there was no guitar solo on it at all. It's the only tune I've ever done that didn't have a guitar solo. So it was completely, I was like, okay, so now we got on the radio, so now what? You know? And then I just kept on, you know, doing what I'm doing. But you're right. I just do what I'm doing, always have, always will. Don't really care about fame, okay? That's not something that interests me all that much. Otherwise, I'd probably be touring a lot more. But I just, you know, I want to make music and have a good time doing it and make sure that that the supporters have, you know, hear good music when we play it that's honest, straight from the heart. And so I don't tour as much for that very, very reason. You know, I'm not chasing anything, tell you the truth.
Well, a lot of these artists, I think, they tour, and some of them, I think, make the mistake of over-touring, and some of them have to do it out of necessity because that's the only way they can make a living these days. Record sales, record deals aren't what they once were. Throughout the 70s, with the deals you had and all the big shows you did, were you smart with your budgeting and your money and able to set yourself all you were?
No, God, no. I don't even own a home. You know,
oh, okay.
I'm a guy that lives in a rental and, you know, drives a 15-year-old car. I have a nice family with daughters and, you know, we all do whatever we can to survive. I'm the same guy I was in 1971, but except I'm an older body. But no, I didn't. There was no money. You know, the money that it looked like there was, that illusion of the money, it was all spent at the studio. It was all, you know, paid back to the record company. I've never seen a, you know, royalty check from them. And so we were not that kind of act. Now, I know some acts have made, you know, they've done well with whatever money they've had, and they've, you know, got some of them have TV shows. But, you know, that was never me. And I can certainly tell you that the music industry has certainly not been something that made me any kind of money of note. Okay, it looked like it did, you know, because we're playing a lot of big places and
right,
we're doing a lot of records, and but all of it was spent on that, and there was always some manager or some agent or some record person who was telling you, you know, we're going to put this up, and you got to spend it on this or spend it on that. So none of us came away with any kind of serious dough. Otherwise, I'd probably have a house today, and I don't, and I never will. So that's about the end of that, you know?
The other big difference you talk about between you now and the younger Frank Marino, because I know that this played a role in your exploration of music, and that was when you were much younger, you did drugs. You had issues with LSD and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Because that was way before. That's what people don't understand. It was the hippie generation, 1967, you know, Summer Love, all that kind of stuff. And I was the young kid who had the older brothers and the older sisters who were into that whole, you know, hippie thing. And so I was the mascot kid that they would drag along because I was 3 or 4 years younger than they were. And, of course, I started doing all the stuff that everyone was doing, which was, you know, smoking grass and hash and dropping acid. Now, by the time I blew my mind on it, which was in 1968, I never did another drug or a drink again. And I only started playing guitar in 68 when I blew my mind, because I actually learned to play guitar while I was in the hospital. So there's a thinking out there that I did this entire psychedelic music career, which I do, based on the fact that I was taking drugs and getting high. I have not had a drug or a drink since I came out of the hospital, but all my music is certainly very much influenced by it. And so, no, drugs like LSD played a part in shaping, let's say, who I became when I became this musician. And, yes, it took a long time to wear off with the situation that I had. So, naturally, a lot of my early music, especially the earliest stuff, was very, very much about that kind of experience. Not about the drugs themselves, but about trying to express those feelings. But that was not the way that I was approaching music at all. In a sense, music for me, and guitar especially, was just a way to try to find how to express what I had been going through with that what I called the trip, the mahogany rush, which is where the words come from, that trip.
So there was one specific thing, Frank, that you did where you overdid it and it just sent you into a spiral that you were actually hospitalized?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Like, I had been doing it for a couple of years and I was a young little kid and I shouldn't have been doing it at all. And, I ended up literally in an asylum for children. And I had to work my way out of that. And that did not just go away in a week. I had been a drummer as a kid. I'm still a drummer, loving, you know, Buddy Rich and jazz and Elvin Jones and, you know, playing jazz drums. And I always thought maybe one day I'll be a drummer, you know. And then in the hospital, they certainly didn't have a set of drums. So there happened to be a guitar there. And that was one of the ways I would, you know, by concentrating on doing something other than freaking, the guitar became almost like, you know, you're in the ocean, you grab onto a piece of floating wood. And I just, you know, stayed with it and stayed with it and stayed with it for no other reason than to just not have to think about the other thing. And when I finally came out, I went out and in a couple of times over the next year or so. And when I finally came out, I was a guitar player. But I wasn't a guitar player to be in a band. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a guitar player in a band. So I would go out and find friends and say, hey, you know, do you want to go over to so-and-so's house and play with me? You know, that's how the band sort of started. And that's why it wasn't about let's be in a band, let's have a record deal, let's go do gigs. There was absolutely none of that in the reasoning behind playing the music I did. And my friends weren't like that either. We were all of the same mind. Let's just have fun. I guess I've often said it's like this. You know, the kids that got into the video games, at some point they would take their PlayStations or whatever, their Nintendo machines, over to their friend's house to play games. They certainly didn't do it with the idea that they were going to become programmers. They were just doing it, and, you know, they were taking their PlayStations over to their friend's houses, and we were taking our guitars and drum sets over to our friend's houses. It was the same type of idea. And business interests, people that did have record companies, figured, hey, let's get these kids to, you know, to go into the studio and record records, and we can sell it and we can make money on it. And of course, because we were kids, we just sort of said, yeah, where do you want me to sign it? Just because they were going to give us equipment and go in the studio and make music. And consequently, you know, made a lot of stupid mistakes early on, you know, agreeing to the wrong kinds of things. If I had to do it over again, or if my kids wanted to do it, I'd certainly say, you know, be very careful about what you do with these people, because they're not your friends. That's basically my point.
So, Frank, where is the music business for you at now, after you said nearly 50 years? I know you did this show. I know, looking at your website, there are no dates currently announced. Where do you want to go? I mean, the business is so different now than, of course, when you started. Do you want to be more active and it's just not, the opportunities aren't there? Or is it just your own decision to not, you know, not really play as much or get out there as much as you once did?
Well, look, as you well know, yes, it has changed, but so has the expenses. So the point is, for an act to go on the road today, it's not the same as an act to go on the road in the 70s. The opportunities are not the same number, the monies are not the same, and the expenses are a lot higher. So for me to say, let's go out on the road, there's two things that either have to happen. You either have to hook up with people who do that kind of thing. We're talking managers, agents, you know, the system. You have to join the system. Or you have to do it yourself. Now, I've always been a type of guy that would rather do it myself, because I don't like the system. I don't think the system is fair to artists, and I don't think it's fair to the public. So I, you know, as much as I can, I like to do things myself. When you do that, the only thing you can do is do it when you can afford to do it. So selling something like the DVD, the Blu-ray, if it sells, you know, enough copies and makes some money, absolutely I want to go on the road because we love doing it. But if it doesn't, it's not like I can invent the money out of thin air to put the, you know, to put the band on the road, and then the only other opportunity is go and, you know, sign up with some management company or some record company or some agency, where then all of a sudden they're doing it their way, and I really don't agree with that. So consequently, you don't see me touring as much. You see me touring every once in a while, sometimes not at all in a year, sometimes for only 30 days. I used to tour 300 days. I love playing. We love it. We love it so much that when we are playing, our sound checks are like 4 hours long. You know, we don't just go in there and check our equipment. We go in there and play all day, and then we play all night. that's where we come from. That's the mentality of who we are and where we come from. But if you can't do it, you just can't do it. And I'm okay with that. If we can't do it, we can't do it. I'll never chase the industry or, you know, chase the gigs or chase the fame or whatever, because I really don't care about that. I care about making good music, and I care that if I do make good music live, the public, the people that support you, have to not be disappointed in what you're doing. I've seen too many people come out of too many shows where they've paid, nowadays they're paying $800 for some tickets to some shows.
Yeah, it's insane.
And they come out and they go, you know, I paid $600 or $800 and, you know, I got to go and meet the guy and shake his hand. And it's like, are you serious? Like, they're actually charging money to meet you and sign a piece of paper? Like, that is like insane. This is like, where have we gotten to? It's obscene that people are doing that.
We talk about it all the time. It's the Wild West out there. I mean, depending upon the band, I mean, there's a laundry list of quote-unquote experiences that you can buy. And everything is for sale. Everything you see on that stage is for sale.
That's totally obscene. I mean, it should not be that way. Look, these people are selling access to their signature or whatever it is they're doing at some of these newer groups. I don't know who they are, okay? But I don't really follow it all that much. But the way I look at it is this. You know, in the old days, in the 70s, some of these guys, you were not even allowed to watch them walk out of their car or go back to their car. There'd be guards all over them, and you weren't allowed to talk to them. And now they just want to meet you because you're going to pay them $600 to sign their paper. I just think that's ridiculous. I just never did it that way. I never will do it that way. And I think that the prices, you know, for some of these tickets to these shows, I see a lot more people come away from those shows and tell you that they didn't think it was worth it. Then I see people that say, hey, I spent, you know, $800 and got these tickets, and wow, was it ever amazing. I mean, you'll get a few guys that'll say that, but the great majority will tell you, you know, well, I had to do it because I thought I'd never see them again. You know, that's basically why they go and they do it. I don't get it. I just don't get it. So that's just never going to be me. I'm the same guy I always was. And when I'm playing a gig, I don't hide out in the dressing room. If I want to watch the other band, I'll go in the crowd. You know, nobody's going to bug you. It's the Woodstock mentality. It's sort of how I think, you know?
Well, Frank, when you were growing, you're Canadian, and when you were growing up in Canada as a kid, what were the bands that you were seeing that came through Canada that really shaped you and that inspired you or influenced you to want to play music and have this attitude about music where you're so pure in the way you want to deliver it and present to the fans? What was it that shaped you as a kid that you saw?
Well, we got the same bands. I mean, I saw The Dead, I saw The Airplane, you know, like a free concert in the center of Montreal. I saw Jimi Hendrix and actually left because I thought it was, you know, noisy. I left Jimi Hendrix's concert. You know, we had these groups, but that wasn't really what was shaping me. It wasn't, you know, like I said, I was a drummer before I was a guitar player, so I was more shaped by drummers and bands, and I wanted to play jazz. But to be shaped by the music scene, we're talking, you know, post-67, 69, to be shaped by the camaraderie that was going on between groups, it was normal. Like if you were doing local festivals or you were watching other bands who were bigger, more famous, everybody was kind of friendly. It was like a camaraderie, and everybody felt like they were doing the same thing. And then when I finally got in the scene in the 70s, and especially towards the mid to late 70s, I saw a lot less camaraderie to the point where by the 80s, I just had enough. I just walked away from Columbia. I said, I don't want anything to do with this system, and I'm just going to do everything on my own. And I didn't, you know, I left Columbia. They didn't leave me. And so I just said, no, you know, I want to stay true to what it was that made me love this when I was young. You know, whether it was the Jimi Hendrixes or the Johnny Winters or the guys that I just loved what they did musically. It was about the sound, not about the spectacle. And by the way, Eddie, anybody listening to this who's like of a slightly older age will tell you, we never called them anything but concerts. You know, we'd say, are you going to the so-and-so concert? We didn't say show. We didn't say spectacle. They became shows and spectacles. The music got put back to the second rate. It was like people weren't even looking at the music anymore. We weren't listening. They were just looking.
Were you ever?
I don't want that. You know, I want it to be about the music, really, not were about the ever, personality.
Were you ever approached, or did you ever have any interest in joining another band? Did an established band ever come to you at some point and say, you know, hey, would you be interested in joining up? We need a guy, or did that not appeal to you?
Well, on two occasions, I was offered that. On the first occasion, I was only 17, I think, or maybe even 16, 17. Paul McCartney was putting Wings together, and somebody came to me from a record label, said, Paul McCartney's putting a band together, and they might want, you know, you could probably get that gig if you go and try. And I said I wasn't interested. And the reason I wasn't interested was because I didn't want to leave my friends behind, which was my, you know, drummer and bass player. So I said, no, no, no. The next time that happened was about 10 or more years later. They were putting together the band called Whitesnake, I think, with David Coverdale. And I was in Germany at the time. And again, it came to me from business people. And they say, you know, we're putting together this group and it's going to be with David Coverdale and blah, blah, blah. And they might want a guitar player. Would you like to be in it? And I said, no, I'm really not interested in doing that, because that would have meant that I was going after a career. And that's just not me. I'm not at all. It's like the last guy to go after a career. It's like, to me, it's kind of funny. You know, it's really comical that people chase that kind of thing. Like I said, the personality shouldn't matter. It's about the music and who's making, you know, and how the music is being made. And when we play a concert, I don't think anybody leaves disappointed. And it's not because we're amazing players. It's because I think they can understand that there's an organicness to it, a kind of an honesty to it, that we're just putting our best foot forward and trying to do whatever we can at the time, you know?
Yeah, which is becoming increasingly rare. One last thing I wanted to ask you, which I read, and I was always wondering if this was true. Are you one of the first people to ever play a guitar wirelessly?
I think I am, because Ken Schaefer, who invented the Schaefer Vega wireless diversity system, he brought me the prototype, because I've always been a very technical guy. You know, I build my own gear and stuff, you know. And so he used me as a kind of a guinea pig. I still have it. It's like a yellow version of it. It's really weird. And he gave that to me. And in those days, I was getting a lot of flack because of the whole Hendrix thing. And people were saying, you know, this guy, you know, saying all that kind of nonsense. And so I used to tape the transmitter with gaffer tape right to the face of my guitar so that people would, because I knew they'd see no chord, and then they'd think, oh, he's faking, you know? So
which there's a lot of that going on today too, Frank. Yeah, that's the biggest problem going on today.
I'd take to the front of the guitar to show people there was a device there, and they wouldn't think I was faking. And then there was this article once in Cream Magazine or something that said, oh, Frank Marino's crazy. He tapes his cigarettes to the front of his guitar. They thought it was a cigarette pack. Yeah, but I was one of the first, if not the first. And yeah, that's when it started. I haven't ever used the cord since, by the way. That was, what, 75?
Really? Wow, yeah. That's interesting, because there's people that still to this day swear by the cord. And
they broke the cord
a long time ago.
Yeah, the techie guys that swear by the cord don't understand why they like the cord. They can tell you, well, it sounds warmer and this and that. I can tell you the technical reason why that is. But if you know that, you can make your own wireless sound exactly the same. It's just that they don't realize what's happening when they use the cord electronically and why they like it. So I've used one ever since, because I know technically how to make my amps or my gear sound like I want to. And so I've used it because I just think the idea of being chained to a cord is really, you know, I mean, look at everyone with their phone today. Imagine if they all had cords. Imagine the traffic jam.
Bit inconvenient for sure.
Yeah.
Frank, I enjoyed the hell out of talking to you, man. I really did. And it's long overdue, and I'm glad we had the chance to do it, and hopefully we'll do it again soon. I'm out of time here at the moment, but I want to tell everybody once again to check out Frank's brand new 6-hour live concert DVD Blu-ray. It's a whole box. You get everything in there. It's a beautiful set. MahoganyRush.net. Okay, it came up for me as .net, but it was .com.
It's .net/DVD, but yeah, it gets you there, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. More specifically, mahoganyrush.net/DVD if you want to get right to the page that has the information about getting this incredible set that you've put out. And, you know, fingers crossed, man, I hope I get a chance to see you live. I know you did a show in New York a number of years ago, but we'll keep an eye on the website and keep me posted should you do some dates, and we'll help you get the word out.
I would love it. Thank you, Eddie. It's been great talking to you, great talking to your people, and I hope we get together sometime soon.
Same here, Frank. Thanks so much. Take care, okay?
All right, man. Ciao.
See ya. There he goes, everybody. Frank Marino. Huge thanks to Frank Marino. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Thanks earlier to Vivian Campbell, who you can see touring with Last in Line. Their latest album is Last in Line 2, and of course, touring with Def Leppard, who seem to always be on tour these days. Hope you guys enjoyed this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to follow on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter and Instagram predominantly. EddieTrunk.com is the official online home. And be sure to listen to me if you're in the U.S. and Canada and a SiriusXM subscriber. Please join me on Channel 106 every day talking rock, 2 to 4, 10 to midnight Eastern on SiriusXM Channel 106. If you're in the U.S. and Canada and you're not on board with Trunk Nation, please look into becoming a subscriber. Even try the trial subscription, which you can do at SiriusXM.com. I think you will absolutely enjoy what I do on a daily basis for Trunk Nation. Thank you guys for listening to the podcast. It is produced, as always, by Katie Irizarry, and I'll see you next Thursday for another all-new episode free, as always, at PodcastOne.com and Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to the quickest podcast ever, brought to you by Kohl's.
Today's topic, Mother's Day.
Just picking out some gifts at Kohl's. There's a KitchenAid mixer calling my name.
Your name? Doing some self-gifting, huh?
Nah, that's for my mom. Baking's her love language.
Love that.
The Fitbit, that's for me. Getting it for the self-care and the Kohl's cash.
That's a big deal.
So's the 20% off and free store pickup. I can get it all in less than an hour.
Talk about shopping goals.
20% offer valid April 28th through May 2nd. Some exclusions apply. See store or Kohl's.com for details.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
No one else gets these rewards.
Sergeant, that is just plain untrue.
What in tarnation?
Sir, PenFed's PowerCash Rewards Card isn't just for military members. Anyone can get cash back on all purchases.
Ah, figgins! You've ruined my favorite song.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/PowerCash. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.